Coming up, as Donald Trump takes office, divisions, fears, and hopes among people of faith. Also, Terry Waite, once the hostage of terrorists in Lebanon, talks with Lucky Severson about how he learned to survive his nearly five-year ordeal alone, blindfolded, and chained to a radiator.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us this inauguration weekend. As Donald Trump takes office, there are sharp divisions among religious groups. Some people of faith are welcoming his presidency and looking forward to more conservative policies being advanced, but others are raising concerns about Trump, his appointments, and his possible agenda. Many faith-based activists participated in rallies urging Trump and the Republican-dominated Congress not to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A new report from the Congressional Budget Office said repealing major provisions of the act would cost 18 million people their insurance in the first year. The U.S. Catholic bishops this week sent a letter to the House and Senate urging lawmakers to ensure that all Americans will have access to health care. If the Affordable Care Act is repealed, the bishop said a replacement plan should be passed immediately. Immigration is another top issue of concern for the faith community. Religious leaders, advocates, and immigrants held rallies in more than 70 cities across the country to protest Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants. They also pledged to fight against the creation of a Muslim registry. In Washington, hundreds gathered at Metropolitan AME Church.
We are here today as people of faith to say that if Jesus were here, Jesus would say, love the stranger.
More than 800 congregations have now declared themselves sanctuaries that will protect undocumented immigrants from being deported. That's about double the number since Election Day. Amid all the contention surrounding the inauguration, many people of faith are also demonstrating for peace and unity. In a series of events across the nation called Circle the Cities with Love, people gathered and held hands in silence and prayer. The project was organized by a nun in Ohio.
I think we're also being called at this time not only to just stand for love, but to help bring about that healing and that peace and justice that love provokes. And that calls us to be citizens, having a voice and being active in helping things heal and be just.
Joining me now with more about religion and the new Trump administration are Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, Jerome Sokolowski, editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, and Stephen Schneck, director of the Institute for Policy Research and Catholic Studies at the Catholic University of America. Welcome to all of you. Kim, it seems to me that this time there's an enormous amount of grassroots activity, marches, petitions, everything.
Well, certainly, as we mentioned, there are people in the faith community, a lot of people that are supportive of the Trump administration and of Donald Trump. But there is a significant group within the faith community as well that's very concerned and is frustrated with some of his appointments and is concerned about some of his policies. And those people are really mobilizing. We've heard about participation in some of the bigger marches. There have been petitions. There have been press conferences and some calls even for civil disobedience. So there is a big mobilization of people who are trying to already express their concerns and say that they will continue to do so. We'll see how much that enthusiasm continues, but for now they are.
There is definitely a lot of church activism on the left here in opposition to who President Trump. But at the same time, we're looking at an administration that has a stronger conservative Christian influence, stronger since the Reagan era. We've had evangelical Christian. We're having evangelical Christians who've been appointed to the cabinet. And there was an interesting piece in Baptist News recently, where Richard Land, who headed the Southern Baptist lobbying arm in Washington, said he's been called numerous times to put forward people for this administration. Hmm.
What do you see, Steve?
Well, to go back to Kim's first point, I think that one of the things that we're seeing is that the churches in the United States are reflecting a broader division in the United States. So just as America in general is divided about Trump, so are our churches divided. In some case, divided within the churches. So not only divided, denomination against denomination, but divided even within denominations about that. And I think that that's part of why we're seeing such religious interest in this inauguration in the beginning of this new president.
Is it mainly talk and petitions and things like that, or is it going to go someplace? Is it going to come?
Of course, there are calls for holy resistance, by some on the left. Some of the African American churches, for example, Sojourners has made this kind of call. So I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, I have heard that the Trump presidency could see the reemergence of a real Christian left in the United States. Maybe you've heard the same thing.
I have. And the National Cathedral hosted the inaugural prayer service. The former dean Gary Hall he came out saying that a church that actually was built as a kind of Westminster Cathedral of the U.S. should have a prophetic role, an oppositional role to this administration. Mm.
And it's always hard to say, are these just symbolic? Does it have an impact? But certainly the civil rights movement was based on a lot of these, public actions and efforts that ended up having a big influence on public opinion. So that's always the open question. And again, to what extent it is talk or to what extent it does lead to pressure on lawmakers and others. But I was going to ask Steve, because the Catholic Church in particular is seeing those big divisions you were just talking about, and I'm wondering how you see the Catholic bishops in particular navigating that relationship with the Trump administration.
It's absolutely fascinating. Catholics, by a very narrow margin, supported Trump. But it's interesting to look a little bit into those numbers. So 60% of white Catholics supported Trump. About 65% of Latino Catholics did not. And that kind of split is evident, in our pews within the Catholic Church, and it's certainly evident, I think, among the bishops. And so there's a real question among the bishops themselves about how to approach this new president. I mean, we've seen some great things, where they're coalescing. Just this week, for example, they came to Congress and argued, for health care and for protecting those parts of the Affordable Care Act, or at least the policies, that would serve America's most vulnerable populations with health care. But there are still many, parts of this administration where we're not quite sure where the bishops are going to come down.
I'm going to be watching the abortion issue in particular, especially as the new president appoints a Supreme Court justice. And of course, for a lot of people in the faith community, from the conservative end of the faith community, that was a big election issue. I heard over and over again during the campaign season from conservative evangelicals and conservative Catholics saying, well, I don't love Trump, but, the Supreme Court and those issues around the Supreme Court are so important. It'll be interesting to see the extent to which he's under pressure to nominate someone that they will be pleased with and the extent to which he does it.
Right. And I've already seen an alert put out by a Christian group about, an Alabama judge who's been mooted for the position that he's not really as anti-abortion as they want him to be.
So that'll be interesting to see how they push him and how he responds to that, given what he might owe them in terms of the election.
I cannot imagine, though, that that Trump can't nominate a conservative judge who would be the sort to overturn Roe v. Wade. I mean, that is the expectation of his base. I just can't see that he could not do that.
There are a few indications of some civil disobedience, I think, too. For instance, the police chiefs, who have said, if you come and want me to go and round up immigrants I'm just not going to do it.
We have the sanctuary church movement, mm-hmm. Churches that are saying they're going to refuse to comply with roundups of immigrants. I think it'll also be interesting to look at perhaps when the Affordable Care Act is repealed and something replaces it. I've already seen dissent or warnings from within evangelical circles about how that's going to affect pastors of small churches who are actually really small entrepreneurs, and they're actually going to lose coverage.
And again, I think that's where, you know, seeing some of these religious communities voicing their opinion and being out there, they are in ways, to a certain extent, it's the usual suspects, you know, the left and the right. But on some of these issues, there is more complicated maneuvering. So, for example, on immigration, that, you know, the sanctuary movement of a few decades ago was clearly on the religious left. Now you have a lot more evangelicals concerned about the immigration issue. Now, I haven't seen them all lining up to be sanctuaries, but you hear more conservative evangelicals speaking out on the issue of immigration. And some of them have already been meeting with Donald Trump about that issue and trying to urge him to moderate some of the statements that he made during the campaign season.
Yeah.
You mentioned the bishops before. I think one of the things that's going to unite every Catholic bishop in the United States is the immigration issue. So, you know, whatever other differences there are, and there are many, in regards to this presidency, the issue of immigration is going to be one you're going to see the bishops pretty much in lockstep in their concern about what's happening to immigrants in the United States.
Let's not forget that immigrants are good for churches, are good for both Catholic and evangelical.
Yeah,
they're really form the rank and file in many churches.
Yeah.
But you were talking earlier about the cabinet picks.
Right.
Do evangelicals and others expect to have a much greater influence on the president now than they have in recent years?
I think they're expecting that through Mike Pence, they'll have a greater influence on policy. Certainly, we have on record what they've said in the past about things like school vouchers, climate change, things like that. As to whether the president will moderate that or tell them to have a different policy than what they've said they would do, that remains to be seen. But certainly, it'll be something to look at.
It's interesting because during the 8 years of the Obama administration, there were those certain religious people that had a lot of access to the White House and for all these
Joshua
events.
DeBond.
And so I'll be watching to see who is the Trump White House's religious liaisons and the religious leaders who come in there. And I think it's not going to be the same people. So that will be sort of
sure
interesting. I've heard
people.
From some people more on the religious leaders on the left who said, for example, at Hanukkah, when Jewish leaders said, well, this may be my last visit to the White House for a while. So, you know, we're in for a change in terms of religion and politics.
Many thanks to Kim Lawton of this program, to Jerome Sokolowski of Religion News Service, and to Stephen Schneck of the Catholic University.
Pleasure.
In other news, at the Vatican, Pope Francis welcomed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas officially opened the Palestinian embassy in Vatican City. The Palestinian leader also warned that prospects for peace in the Middle East will suffer if Trump keeps his promise to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. After the meeting, the Vatican called for direct negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. The United Nations has issued another emergency humanitarian appeal for Syria. The group demanded that relief workers be allowed inside besieged areas where an estimated 700,000 civilians, about half of them children, are still living without sufficient access to food and medical help. The new warning said that harsh winter weather is causing more suffering. The Nigerian government mistakenly bombed a refugee camp this week, killing more than 70 people and injuring more than 100. The Nigerian fighter jet had been searching for members of the Islamic terrorist group Boko Haram. The casualties included aid workers Doctors Without Borders and the Red Cross were both on the ground at the time of the attack, attempting to help the thousands there in need of humanitarian assistance. Approximately 4.7 million people in Nigeria are in dire need of aid. We have a Lucky Severson story today about Terry Waite, in the 90s a hostage negotiator for the Archbishop of Canterbury. Waite himself became the hostage of terrorists in Lebanon for nearly 5 years. He spoke about how he learned to survive by keeping himself alive mentally and spiritually. Waite has a new book of poetry and reflections, Out of Silence.
I was prepared to face death. I was prepared to face brutalization.
You were prepared?
Yeah, I was prepared as best I could be. No one can be fully prepared for an event like that.
There was a time when the name Terry Waite was in the international news almost every day. Famous hostage negotiator himself taken hostage.
Good evening. Mr. Terry Waite, the last British hostage in Lebanon, flew home today to the rain and to the cheers.
That was 1991, 5 years after Waite, an envoy for the Archbishop of Canterbury, was kidnapped in Beirut. He was there to negotiate the release of Western hostages. Most of his time in captivity was spent in solitary confinement, total isolation.
I mean, the conditions were chained to the wall, sleeping on the floor, in a room where there was no natural light. When anyone came in the room, I had to wear a blindfold. No books or papers for years. Nothing, absolutely nothing.
His friend and colleague, Phil Bigley.
I don't know how anybody who is held in captivity and chained to a wall for so long is not psychologically damaged. He's not only come through it, he's come through it and is still extremely balanced, extremely compassionate.
Episcopal Canon Carol Marsh is an acquaintance of Waite. She says he went to Beirut the last time, even though he knew he could be taken hostage by Hezbollah.
But my understanding is that when he went the last time to Lebanon, when he was taken hostage, that was not an official trip. In fact, he was requested not to go, as I understand it.
So he knew his life was in danger?
Probably. I think it was probably, could have been in danger all the time.
We met Waite in his 15th century home in Suffolk County, England. In the kitchen, a gallery of pictures of a man who has kept few mementos of his life. He's with the Pope, the Queen, presidents.
Those are some of the people I got out of Iran during the time of the Iranian Revolution.
Do you have any idea how many hostages you helped release?
No, not really.
But quite a few.
Quite a few. It goes back over the years.
And very few were held in captivity as long as Terry Waite.
As you see your physical body begin to deteriorate rather more quickly than you would hope for, you say, is that going to happen to me mentally and spiritually? Am I going to fall apart inside? And I said, now is the time to take an inner journey, to get to know yourself better. It looks as though you're going to have the time to do that.
The secret, he says, is to keep yourself alive mentally.
Well, I began to write in my head. I began to use my imagination. The book, first book I wrote, called Taken on Trust, was written in my head. Now, people say to me, do you mean you wrote every sentence, every comma, every dot? No, not at all. But I got the general drift of what I was going to say and what I wanted to say.
And he wrote poetry, still does. This is from his latest book called Out of the Silence.
Be still, listen to the inner voice, learn to love, let compassion guide your actions, walk calmly through the mists of unknowing. The kingdom is yours.
In the complete isolation of his cell, he not only talked to himself, he imagined conversations with people he had known. He pretended to live a normal life, even holding regular communion.
I would save a little bread for my supper, pour a little water into a beaker, and say the communion service to myself.
To keep from going mad, he silently recited prayers he had memorized from the Anglican prayer book. He did this 1,763 days, chained, often blindfolded, sometimes tortured.
I said this to myself in the face of my captors. I said, you have the power to break my body. You've tried. You have the power to bend my mind, and you've tried, but my soul is not yours to possess. In other words, my soul lay in the hand of God.
Did you know your captors? I mean,
No, I never saw them.
Never spoke with them?
I said, does it not say in the Quran you mustn't steal? Oh, no, they said, we mustn't steal. I said, how is it you steal me? You're taking my life. They said, we'll go and ask the chief about that. They went and asked the chief, came back a couple of weeks later. I said, what did the chief say? The chief said, we mustn't talk to you.
When Waite came home to London, the world had changed. The Berlin Wall had fallen, apartheid had ended in South Africa. His wife and children didn't know him, nor he them. For almost 5 years, he had been speaking with only himself and didn't know how to communicate with his loved ones. It took months to adjust back to reality, months in the spotlight. The hero comes home, alive. In the meantime, he took the book he had written in his head and put it on paper.
You got enough mails to read there, 2,712.
that's just today's.
Phil Bigley met Terry Waite after his brother Ken was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in Iraq in September 2004.
He gave us hope, but not it was realistic. It wasn't unrealistic. You know, we never lost sight of the fact that it was a very critical situation.
The family has now received absolute proof that Ken Bigley was executed by his captors.
After 3 weeks in captivity, his brother was decapitated. In 2012, Terry Waite returned to Beirut to meet with Hezbollah, his former captors.
Well, they were surprised to see me.
He says he went there to reconcile and to lay to rest what he described as the ghosts of the past.
If you continue to hold grudges and continue to hold anger in your heart against the other, that will do you more harm eventually in the long run than it does others. I've seen that happen.
He says his faith was never challenged while he was a hostage, but it has changed.
I was brought up as an Anglican, and I could be, when I was younger certainly, a little dismissive of people who followed other traditions. And I recognize that there are many pathways. You know, there are many pathways to God.
So now he has an additional pathway, the Society of Friends, the Quakers, who value the unspoken word.
I value the liturgical life of the Anglican Church and of others, but I also value the use of corporate silence, which is something that is sadly lacking in our society today.
It was, after all, silence that allowed Terry Waite to discover himself.
But don't think, you know, I'm the great hero. Don't think I'm the great man who's survived this wonderful, this remarkable experience. I'm an ordinary sort of person, very much so. It's just that I found a key to living that sort of life, which is develop the interior life. Don't ignore the interior life. Don't just be content with the superficialities of life. How can we know such a mystery? How can we touch the intangible?
Waite now devotes his life to humanitarian causes worldwide. He still works for the release of hostages, but mostly with the devastated families left behind. It's estimated there are about 3,000 hostages worldwide. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in London.
President Obama this week designated a new national monument in honor of the civil rights movement. Obama said several landmarks in Alabama were all part of the new Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument. The landmarks include 16th Street Baptist Church, where four girls died in 1963 after Ku Klux Klan members detonated more than a dozen sticks of dynamite. The landmarks also include the historic A.G. Gaston Motel, campaign headquarters for Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders. Two other churches, Bethel Baptist Church and St. Paul United Methodist Church, were also designated. The National Park Service will manage the sites and consider them for visitor centers and historic preservation. Finally, on our calendar, Friday is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a memorial day declared by the United Nations that commemorates the millions of victims of the Holocaust. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, the Howard University Gospel Choir singing Hold On, Change Is Coming at Metropolitan AME Church in Washington.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.